U.S. versus Urias, and we hear first from Mr. Spurgeon.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Steve Spurgeon from Marfa, Texas, and I have been asked to bring
a great city in the West.
we are pretty hip these days.
Yes, you are.
I've been asked to bring glad tidings from the lawyers who practice with me in the remote Big Bend region to the court, and it is indeed an honor to be here today. I represent Anna Victoria Urias Marufo, our appellant in this case. It is, a privilege to be here, and I am hopeful and confident that the court's decision in this case will serve as a guide for the bar and the bench concerning motions to withdraw guilty pleas under the factors set forth in Carr versus the United States and the Supreme Court decisions of Padilla and Chavez. This case is also important for my young client, Anna, who now at age 25 and a lawful permanent resident since she was a young child, is looking at banishment for life from her adopted country. She pled guilty, Your Honors, as you know, to aiding and abetting the importation of marijuana under longstanding immigration law, and to recite the terms Justice Stevens used in Padilla. The immigration consequences are succinct, clear, and explicit. Anna will be deported from her country after she finishes serving her term of imprisonment. After learning of the immigration laws required for that were going to require her to be deported, before she was sentenced, she retained new counsel, who promptly filed a motion to withdraw the guilty plea under Rule 11D2B of the federal rules that provides that a criminal defendant is permitted to withdraw his plea before sentencing if he provides a fair and just reason.
Mr. Berg,
Your Honor.
Yeah, let's start talking about this, because this is, I think it's an important case. She was, in fact, informed that there would be a risk of deportation, and several other, statements were made if she pled guilty. She understood that, and she knew that. Now, it seems to me that your argument is that they should have also indicated not that there may be the risk of deportation, but there was absolutely no doubt that there would be deportation because of the charge and the plea to that particular charge in this particular case, which was aggravated felony, which includes an illicit trafficking in controlled substances. Now, is that the thrust of your argument?
Sort of. That analysis, Your Honor, depends upon whether we are looking at this in terms of the 7 Carr factors that your author authored, okay, and or if we're looking at it in terms of the Padilla factors that Judge Dennis wrote his concurrence on in the American case. It depends on how do we want to look at that. Okay. This court has determined in Carr, Your Honor, that no single factor is determinative when you're looking at all the factors. That should include whether or not the plea was knowing and voluntary as one of the factors that needs to be weighed. And it's essential. And I probably didn't do as good a job in my brief that I should have. It is essential that the court understand the timeline that was done in this case. Our district court in West Texas, Judge Robert Janelle, moves his docket. In this particular case, Anna was arraigned on January 24th. The plea deadline was March 2nd, 37 days later. During that time, her bond was denied. Her boyfriend, a co-defendant, the father of her youngest child, he received a bond. Anna did not, because she was a resident, and she had discussions with her lawyer about her resident status and why she didn't receive a bond. That was her first attorney, the court-appointed attorney in this case.
This is all in the record?
Absolutely. She was told by her lawyer that the reason she didn't get a bond because she was a resident. She discharged her court-appointed counsel and hired Ms. Carpenter, the plea counsel in this case. She didn't enter her appearance until February the 2nd, less than 30 days from the plea hearing. Now, Your Honor, this court can take judicial notice that my client was in Pecos, Texas, detained. Her lawyer is in Odessa, Texas, in excess of 80 miles. Anna stated in her sworn declaration and testified at the hearing that the first time she met her lawyer was on the morning when she pled guilty. Now, Your Honor, and Your Honor, Judge Davis, you addressed this issue in the United States versus Grant case, and you stated that a guilty plea is a grave and solemn act that is accepted with care and discernment, and you quoted from the Hyde decision. Surely, meeting your lawyer for the first time on the morning you plead guilty, close assistance of counsel requires more than that. And that's why the factors involved in this case and Carr are not even, they're weighed according to the facts of the case.
Now, let me make sure that I understand. This is not a 2255. That's not the procedural vehicle now, Padilla has an ineffective assistance of counsel prong to it, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're really talking about a Rule 11 motion, and under what aspects can you withdraw that plea?
That's correct, Your Honor. Indeed, that's one of our points of error in this case. I believe it was the McKnight case, but I could be wrong. I believe it was the McKnight case in which I believe, Judge Davis, you were on that panel. And you reversed you reversed the trial court and allowed the withdrawal of a guilty plea on the basis of ineffective assistance of counsel. Now, what's important about that, Your Honor, that in this particular case, the trial court and in his memorandum opinion stated that the central reason, the main reason, the most important reason for the denial of the plea was because my client didn't assert her innocence. And that's in his memorandum order. And the judge further went on to comment on the fact that Padilla ineffective assistance claim is not applicable in a motion to withdraw a case, but it is applicable in a 2255. That was one of that when we're talking about the abuse of discretion, is perhaps my strongest point in my central argument.
So you're saying that he erred as a matter of law in not considering the Padilla, at least the thrust of Padilla, in a Rule 11 context?
Well, Your Honor, it's a discretionary call. It's a privilege issue. I mean, the withdrawal of a guilty plea is a privilege. It's not a right. And it's based upon the equities involved. And therefore, I think that's why when the court went into the difference between close counsel and ineffective assistance of counsel, and I think it was the McDonald case, I could be wrong, that was discussed in, that's why there's the distinction between that. But this is a discretionary call that's reviewed on an abuse of discretion standard. And when the court takes the innocence issue, which our Supreme Court has spoken on, they've said that oftentimes in the Padilla decision, oftentimes a person will be willing to risk a lot more time in jail for the opportunity to remain in the United States.
Let me tell you what my problem is. I mean, Padilla was a habeas case.
It was.
And the general rule is that the district court does not consider ineffective assistance of counsel except in a post-conviction habeas case because of the requirement generally that you have a hearing and you don't need to. It's very disruptive at the early stages of a case to have to stop everything and call witnesses and have a hearing. So, I mean, that is the general rule. And why should we depart from that general rule? Padilla doesn't require us to do that.
Your Honor, you don't have to depart from the rule because it's identified in one of the seven factors. It goes to the fact that her plea wasn't knowing and voluntary because she didn't have close counsel available. And that's something that Your Honor has participated in on the panel. We're not having to create new law here. This is simply a matter of how do we apply the seven factors in light of Padilla and in light of Chavez, where Chavez tells us that Padilla broke new ground. Imposed new duties.
I don't know. I mean, Padilla says that it's that a counsel is deficient when they don't tell the client before the guilty plea that there's mandatory deportation. But that's all in the context of a habeas case.
Well, it is, Your Honor, but But Chida's opinion, I believe the language was Padilla, in determining that Padilla was not retroactive, they stated Padilla broke new ground and imposed new obligations on criminal defense counsel. And those obligations run up through the plea. I mean, we've had the law for a long time that a lawyer had a duty to seek to negotiate, and the Sixth Amendment applies to that kind of thing. The seven factors in Carr cover this particular situation because you weigh it based upon the individual circumstances. Actual innocence isn't something that should be weighed as predominant as perhaps this is a two-day trial. We're not talking about a waste of judicial economy.
Well, I'm certainly concerned about protecting the constitutional rights of a defendant, but we're also concerned about running the railroad. So how many of these claims are potentially out there? I mean, after the plea and after the defendant starts reflecting on, all the how long he's going to be there, and it really hits him what's happened to him. I mean, he can come back and as I understand what you're arguing for, he could say, oh, the lawyer didn't advise me that I was going to get this enhancement. Or the lawyer didn't advise me that this is going to be a crime of violence, and it's going to, all these fairly complicated sentencing issues. And so the district judge then has got to stop everything and convene a hearing on whether it was deficient, and then would the guy have taken the plea even without that? How disruptive is that going to be in a district court's trial docket?
Well, let me answer that two ways. The fact that we're hearing this for the first time tells you perhaps how often it doesn't occur, all right? This is the first time that I believe that this court is addressing this particular issue. Secondly, Your Honor, we're not complaining about sentence. This isn't a sentencing issue. It's not an enhancement issue. My client doesn't have any problem with the sentence. Her issue is being deported for life after she finishes serving her sentence. That's what the issue is. With respect to the disruptive nature, that's one of the factors that should be considered in the overall scheme. This is a two-day trial, tops, okay? This is a case where they've got a confession. This is a case where she was caught in the act, all right? This is not a particularly difficult case to try, and Judge Janelle moves his cases. In this particular case, it was less than 60 days, I think it's 58 days, between time of arraignment and the trial setting. They go quick. This is not a disruptive situation with respect to the court. Now, I'm not a judge, and you guys obviously have done in that capacity, and who am I to make that evaluation, but it's a relatively easy case to try.
Well, but we're talking about creating a rule that may be disruptive. That's what I'm talking about.
And how do you avoid that?
Yeah, I mean, how disruptive is it going to be? Would this rule be on a trial court's docket, given the potential number of mistakes or alleged mistakes a lawyer could make in advising his client about taking the plea?
Well, Your Honor, that's one of the issues with why the plea colloquy that you've referred isn't particularly helpful in this kind of setting. The judge doesn't have the pre-sentence investigation report, doesn't understand the immigration consequences. They're simply asking questions about, did you talk about it with your lawyer? There's no invasion of the attorney-client privilege or exactly what was said, okay? And so the plea colloquy, that goes back to the plea colloquy, I believe. But the rule itself, if we didn't have the Rule 11, Your Honor, to be able to file a motion to withdraw a guilty plea, then why are we here? I mean, is it going to cause some disruption? Perhaps. But does that trump the law? I think that's a factor that needs to be considered and be given weight according to the facts of the case.
Well, you could invalidate the plea as it did in Padilla in a post-conviction habeas proceeding, too.
Exactly. And the question is that really one of the factors is judicial economy in the seven factors of Carr? I mean, is that really what we're going to do? We're going to jump through all this, and then if we lose, then we file our 2255. Wouldn't it be simpler to allow her to withdraw her plea, the case is fresh, set it for trial, and she has her opportunity to perhaps get to stay in the United States? I think Orofio discussed that in the Third Circuit.
That's not what we do in other contexts. In other words, if a defendant comes in after the trial and moves for a new trial and says, I had ineffective assistance of counsel, typically the court's going to say, well, file your habeas complaint, and that's, as I understand it, that's the general rule. So why shouldn't that be the general rule here?
I think it is the general rule here, Your Honor. I don't think that Carr negates that.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. All right, Mr. Gay.
Good morning. May it please the court. Well, I'd like to begin by, I guess, dealing with an assumption, Judge Garza, and one of the questions you asked, which dovetails into an observation that you made, Judge Davis, about why this shouldn't be handled in a habeas proceeding. In this case, Ms. Urias had, she's had three lawyers. She was denied bond because she was determined to be a resident alien. She knew early on that she had immigration problems. She was specifically asked by the magistrate judge, have you discussed with your attorney the effects and consequences of your guilty plea on your immigration status? Yes, sir. Do you understand that by pleading guilty, you may be deported? And it goes on from there. What's interesting about this case is that this is truly an ineffective assistance of counsel 2255 procedural test, if it's going to be anything, because there's a critical fact, the 500-pound elephant in the room, is that we don't know what Ms. Carpenter, her lawyer, told her. And specifically, on page 15 of the hearing on this motion, the district court asks, did you talk to Ms. Carpenter, counsel? I did ask for the file, and to that extent, I did not ask her any other questions. Specifically, counsel didn't really want to get the answer to that question, it appears to me, at this time, because we're going to litigate this issue again in a 2255 later. In this case, the district court specifically found the defendant's claims that she thought the magistrate judge was talking about her bond to not be credible. We have a credibility finding that is really cloaked in a presumption of reasonableness or an abuse of discretion standard. So in this case, what we have are the Carr factors, and if you apply the Carr factors, it's overwhelmingly that the judge did not abuse his discretion. We have basically facts showing that she was advised by her counsel. That was the question. She answered it yes, under oath. She was told that she could, and of course, no one knows that it may be virtually certain, but you notice in the language that's often used, it's talked in the conditional sense because it hasn't happened yet. And to talk about something that may happen as if it's going to happen, that's a very thin reed.
That to me is, I think, the kind of the critical question here. There is, and the question to you is this. Is there a legally material difference that the court has to account for between advising a client of the possibility of deportation as opposed to the certainty of deportation in the context of a knowing voluntary plea? That to me is the real issue in this case. Of course, Padilla doesn't say that, but that's the issue.
I believe that ultimately it is a totality of the circumstances test under Carr. And we look at all of the factors, not one in isolation. I think we're all in agreement about that. Ultimately, I think on this record, the only vehicle that the defendant has is to go under Strickland, cause and prejudice, 2255, because then, as Judge Davis points out, this court does not ordinarily address claims of ineffective assistance of counsel on direct appeal. In fact, I would suggest to you that this record prevents that analysis because Ms. Carpenter wasn't called. And certainly the government was under no obligation to call Ms. Carpenter. They have the burden.
But, of course, the district court is authorized to have a hearing on a motion to withdraw a plea.
Certainly, that's correct, Your Honor.
And, you know, one possibility in a situation like this, it seems to me, would be for the judge to, I think what we had here was an affidavit by the defendant saying
that
the counsel didn't tell her about the mandatory nature of the deportation, would be to call for an affidavit by the counsel. Did you tell her that or didn't you? And if they make out a prima facie case by getting that affidavit from the lawyer, then require the judge to have a hearing.
And that is exactly not our case, unfortunately.
I know, but I mean, I'm talking about what should the rule be? I mean,
well, I don't know that it should be a rule, but I think as a matter of effective representation, you know, because you can tell the judge has got this on his mind. He specifically asked, did you talk to her? Yes, I did. But I didn't ask her that question. So it's, you know, this is what I'm not suggesting anything more than what we're really doing here is, and I don't criticize, or I'm not being judgmental here, but this is really two bites at one apple in the sense that we're going to litigate the car factors, take a swing there, see if we can get it that way, and now we're going to come back most definitely with the 2255 and litigate this again.
I mean, wouldn't it be more efficient to go ahead and handle it at the motion to withdraw?
But as I said before, perhaps, candidly, the record doesn't tell us what Ms. Carpenter would have said or whether she was available or we don't know.
One of the distinctions between a Rule 11 ruling and a 2255 is the discretion that the district court has in, as you say, the totality of the circumstances. The car factors, are appropriate, but they're not necessarily on point vis-a-vis guilt. We're not really talking about guilt anymore. We're talking about this other factor that has been put into the new landscape of criminal law and criminal procedure that whether we should take advantage. It seems to me that he would be within his discretion to grant the motion and within his discretion under these facts to deny the motion and under the totality of the circumstances. My only concern, I'm going to ask you this. You know, in my experience, you know, trying cases on the border, and we used to try three or four of these cases almost every week on the border, is the only two times that a jury, in effect, nullified the evidence was with single mothers who I presume they believed that, you know, they needed the money to do that. Now, and it seems to me that's exactly what Ms. Urias it is. I mean, there is a chance that a jury, even though she confessed to it, okay, but there is a chance that jury could just say, hey, listen, we're just not going to convict her.
I understand, and I...
This is a horrible supposition on my part, but that's okay. Go ahead.
Well, it is a swamp, and I'll tread lightly around the edges, but there are sort of a theme running through certain cases that spouses, girlfriends end up at the hands of, in this case,
their boyfriends.
Boyfriend, co-defendant. It inured to her benefit in the sense that she did get safety valve. She did get a benefit from her
plea. She got a pretty sweet deal.
She got a deal. And, you know, this isn't just, this is really, you know, we've got backpackers walking through the desert, carrying backpacks. It's really got a human trafficking component to it. People die out there. This isn't some small incidental operation. This is actually serious in the sense, not that all aren't serious, but these facts aren't as
Did they arrest her there at the national park or close to the national park? Is that where?
I believe that she was detained, yes, right there on the side of the road, and that's where, because they detained her pending finding those backpackers, because they reviewed her phone, and there's communications between her and her boyfriend. We're past the balloon, which is the aerostat blimp, and so they knew that they were looking for individuals that they were going to try to pick up.
Let me ask you this. I know the, we have the car factors, which are a number of factors, but in light of Padilla, wouldn't the court be required to invalidate the plea either on a motion to withdraw or on habeas if the court found ineffective assistance under Strickland, that is, deficient performance and prejudice? I mean, you could throw out the rest of the factors, can't you?
The judge certainly could, Your Honor.
I mean, wouldn't he be required to under Padilla?
I think we would be hesitant to say required, because this is cloaked with the abuse of discretion standard. And as part of weighing all of the factors, if the court focused on it, and this is not our case, but if there was evidence in the record, and it goes, if you look at almost every case that really talks about this, there is either a finding or the government even concedes that they were just misadvised or weren't told. In one case, the lawyer said, I didn't even realize that the defendant wasn't a citizen. And so once you get to that point, I think that the judge applying the car factors, the seventh factor, absolutely could.
But why wouldn't he be required to if Padilla says, look, if the counsel doesn't advise the defendant of the mandatory nature of the deportation and his prejudice, it's set aside. The only thing they did was they sent it back for a finding on prejudice.
I think the way I would phrase it is that it would be an abuse of discretion, perhaps.
Okay.
And maybe that's the way, instead of required, because that's the rubric that we operate under in the Rule 11 context.
Okay. Let me just add, just when you back off and look at this, the court is required to upset a plea if there's a fair and just reason for doing so.
Mm-hmm.
Now, shouldn't that be an easier standard to apply than the habeas standard?
Well, going back to your question about what the potential long-term effects, collateral consequences, whatever phrase we want to use, is that there's a certain amount of buyer's remorse that occurs in the guilty plea context, where a defendant pleads guilty, goes back, has 60 days, 30 days, whatever it is, to think about it, and wants out for a variety of reasons. And Rule 11 operates under, there's a series of steps there. Once the guilty plea is accepted, the absolute right to withdraw your plea goes away. And so then you have to basically show a fair and just reason. And then that's where Carr comes in and gives the judge a series of factors to consider in determining whether a fair and just reason has been determined. One of the critical ones, and it's always been, is that when you admit you did it under oath in a solemn plea colloquy, assertion of innocence is a huge part of the analysis. It doesn't fit neatly with this Padilla paradigm that we're looking at, and that is close assistance of counsel, and it dovetails back on itself as to whether or not the plea was knowing and voluntary. But nevertheless, I think that's the rubric that we have works perfectly well in addressing Padilla claims, and addresses Judge Dennis's concern in Marroquin, that we do want close assistance of counsel during the plea process. It's just that on this record, we can't get there because we just don't know. And ultimately, I think that this is one of those cases where applying the factors, and as Judge Garza said, it could be upheld if the judge had gone the other way, And under an abuse of discretion, it's, I don't believe, under these facts, possible to say that the judge abused his discretion
but
in this case.
Should the judge have found out more about the circumstances by having a hearing or at least requiring, you know, some kind of showing by defense counsel?
And for the record is as we find it, and in this case, as I mentioned, we do not know. But what we do know is that from the very beginning, she knew she had immigration problems because she couldn't get out on bond. She got rid of that lawyer, hired another one. She knew, based on her sworn assertions, that she had talked to her lawyer about the consequences of her plea. Then the magistrate judge, to put an icing on top of that cake, tells her, you know, you may not ever get to come back. And goes through a list of horrors, and she still proceeds to plead guilty. It's this record is pretty strong on the side of no, you knowingly and voluntarily pled guilty. And so one of the downsides, and Padilla talks about this, is that the reason why this Rule 11 context isn't so it's difficult to show under Strickland prejudice where you do not assert a claim of innocence. And so
and that's the other question out there. Is Strickland going to be changed with this new Padilla landscape? In other words, is the prejudice guilty or not, as opposed to, and I'm not sure what the answer
I'm
is.
I'm not either, Your Honor, but I think you're right. I think that that's really, and in the Strickland context, I mean, it's an uphill battle for sure.
But in the context of withdrawing a plea, prejudice is determined by whether the person would have entered the plea had he been given effective assistance.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what you look at, isn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor, and so it's slightly different. And so there, to say that this, a motion to withdraw a plea in this context could conceivably be an effective vehicle and this court could, in the appropriate case, terminate right here and say, no, we're finding the plea was involuntary and sending it back, applying the existing framework. But that's not the case that we have, and so I don't believe it would be the appropriate remedy in this case.
But seems to be the trend among the other circuits is to get away from this rule that we relegate this issue to habeas in the withdrawal of the plea concept. Isn't it? Did you agree with that?
I don't think that's the case. I think that is true in cases where it is undisputed that misadvice was given. And I found no case that was sent back that's like this one where we actually don't have a record that shows that any misadvice was given.
Well, we do have her affidavit.
But she was found not to be credible, and that dovetails back on her sworn assertions at the time of her plea that she had discussed it. And so once we have that credibility finding, and then the judge is perfectly in a position and stated good reasons for doing so, that her claims that she thought the magistrate judge was talking about her bond when he actually says, by pleading guilty, you understand that, it's well within, and I think the district court correctly ruled, that no, under this record, I don't believe you on that.
But, you know, that's the essential really issue in this case, and that is she doesn't want to withdraw her plea because she's not guilty. She wants to withdraw her plea so that she at least has a chance of not being deported and being convicted. And that's just a little bit different. It's a little different twist to the Carr Strickland, where we really are talking about guilt or innocence in this thing. That's what's so strange about this case. This is an interesting case.
I do agree that, and as counsel pointed out, and as we've all observed today is that this does add a new gloss onto the existing analysis, and that is, what do you do in circumstances where, for lack of a better word, the defendant wants to swing for the fences and take the consequences of being found guilty?
And see, on both the Strickland and in this Rule 11 colloquy, what you have hanging, this big elephant in the room, is her confession. You know, once you have that confession in the mix, I really don't know how you can
show prejudice
or abuse of discretion with the Rule 11. That's the real problem with it.
The strength of the case, and you gloss on top of that, she got a good deal. It wasn't like she pled guilty to a life sentence. And, you know, she really did get, she got safety valve, three levels, and served, I believe, her sentence was 37.
That's not what she's complaining
about. Right, but that is one of the factors, is when you plead guilty, did you get something in return for your plea? And this is one of those cases where the record shows, and I think that does talk to the Carr factors as well.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gay.
Thank you.
Back to you, Mr. Burden.
Briefly, Your Honor, I'd like to address each of you on this case. Judge Garza, with respect to the issues you raised about how, in your experience, you've had jury nullification, the record shows in this case that my client was raped when she was a young child. The child that was born from that rape was the reason she dropped out of school. That's in the record in the pre-sentence investigation report. And those are all, and there's abundance of evidence that she was under the influence of her boyfriend who set all this stuff up, and he's the guy that got the bond and got the identical sentence. Those are exactly the kind of issues that we're talking about, that if she'd had an opportunity. But there's more than that, Your Honor. Judge Davis, you talked about the good deal. Well, she got a good deal if you're a citizen of the United States, and when you finish your term, you get to stay. But because her lawyer did not seek an immigration safe disposition, there were a lot of ways to keep her in the United States. For instance, it is not, in my experience, I have gone to the U.S. attorneys, and I have said, will you please let my client plead guilty to a state charge of possession with a sentence similar or more than what she would receive in this case, and we've gotten that done. And so there's ways to plead guilty to a drug crime and remain in the United States, because discretionary relief is available in immigration court for a person like this with these facts. Secondly, there was no attempt to even try to address misprison of a felony. She was involved, but it's not unusual to get misprison of a felony on first offender cases where you have a young woman with children and things of this nature.
And that and wasn't proposed.
It wasn't, no, because she met her lawyer for the first time on the morning when she pled guilty. I mean, how can we say she got close assistance of counsel when she meets her lawyer for the first time when she pleads guilty? And that's not a credibility issue. That's the facts. That's the record.
I mean, I don't see where that's a, you know, you can have a 10-minute talk or you can have an hour talk and cover everything under the landscape.
Well, this was in the courtroom when she's signing the papers talk. It was, hi, Ms. Carpenter, here are the papers, sign here. Say yes, okay? And that's how this happened. With respect to the Padilla, you indicated that Padilla just dealt with the prejudice, but just dealt with the ineffective assistance problem. That's true. The Kentucky Supreme Court found prejudice and dismissed the case, but when it was remanded back. But what's important about that, Your Honor, is that the Supreme Court gave us some prejudice guidance in it, and they cited the case Janvier versus United States, a Second Circuit case, which Judge Stevens referred to as the case when a lawyer doesn't ask for a judicial recommendation against deportation, which was available in the old law, that's ineffective and the case comes back. In this particular case, the lawyer didn't ask for any kind of immigration disposition that was safe in nature. And whether or not she would have gotten it in the issue, the issue is, did you ask? You have a duty to ask. With respect to the other issues about the plea colloquy, I know what it says, and the judge asked the questions. But this court has never held that cures prejudice under Strickland or under Padilla. This court has never held that the plea colloquy for immigration purposes satisfies that.
Well, certainly, though, if the magistrate judge had said, do you know that if this plea is accepted, you will be almost certainly deported. Surely you couldn't have prevailed on a prejudice prong. Of
well, let me tell you that you would think not, but there are state one. I think it was the Supreme Court of New Mexico, or maybe the appellate court, that had that very issue, and they found that it's not the judge's duty. The judge doesn't have all the facts. The judge doesn't have the knowledge. The judge doesn't know the background. The lawyer does then, and it's the lawyer's duty to provide that advice, not the court's. And I believe that Judge Dennis got that correct when you wrote your concurring opinion on the Merrickman case. It's not the judge's duty. They've got enough to do without having to be an expert in immigration law. And it's the lawyer's duty to be able to look at this. This, you don't have to be an expert in this case. The statute's real clear. This is exactly like Padilla. I think Justice Stevens said a lawyer with a modicum of understanding could look at those statutes and make that call. But this didn't happen because the lawyer only... They said, hi, plead guilty on the morning of the plea. That can't be close assistance. I would disagree with counsel. I believe that this record has enough to send it back, particularly, Your Honor, when the trial court says, I find the fact she didn't proclaim her innocence as the most important car factor. That has to be an abuse of discretion in light of the totality of the circumstances on this case.
Well, it doesn't mean he didn't consider the other car factors.
He said he did consider the other. That's correct. He did say he considered the others, okay? But the weight that was put on it, that was the emphasis. And that was the wrong emphasis. The emphasis should have been, this case could be tried in 2 days. The emphasis should have been, the witnesses are all here, we have a confession. The emphasis should have been, the government isn't prejudiced as a result of they're here. We can try this case tomorrow. This was a case that the other factors involved in the car factors.
You have a red light, Mr. Bird.
I do.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate the argument.
Come visit us in Marfa.
All right. We have your case.